Accession number 27185, reel 25.
Major Barras, reel 25.
You were saying that the second in command of the battalion got back to brigade headquarters.
To the, yeah, he eventually got back to 56th Brigade.
Yes.
And he got on to 7th Armoured Division headquarters.
Yes.
And said that we had to have tanks and anti-tank guns. Now, they, being an armoured division, they would have had their anti-tank weapons would have been mounted, wouldn't they, on tracks?
Sort of,
I don't know what they call. They're not priests, are they?
No.
Priests were the field guns.
Yes.
But anyway, he said they've got to be. They must have them up there by first light. And of course, the other thing is our own anti-tank guns, our 6-pounders.
Yes. You hadn't taken those with you.
No.
Had your carriers gone with you on this attack into Verrières?
I don't think so. No.
So it's just you on foot. So
we're all on foot. Yeah.
Yes.
Now they did appear at first light, and we had a prettiest, best sort of consolidated, firm defensive position that we could then complete.
It's in the orchards around.
Around the orchards, yes, and in the area there, so that if they attacked, we would be in a far better position than we were before. But they didn't. The next thing we found out that morning is our CO had gone.
What had happened to him?
Well, he'd been sent away. Well, I don't know quite who was to blame for the situation we found ourselves in, without any anti-tank defences and no tanks. Now, I believe, from what I understood later, that tanks were supposed to be with us. But in the usual sort of sweeping hand of 7th Armoured, I think they sort of, they was the idea, well, we'll join you later sort of thing. I'm not sure. Either that or else Higson waited for them and they didn't come. So he said, we'll look a bit wet if we stand around saying we're not going to attack until they come. Because remember, this is early days in Normandy, and we were overconfident. We hadn't had much opposition, and we really hadn't developed the ways in which we were going to attack in future with a combination of infantry and tanks. We never ever attacked again without tanks. And good support from our own anti-tank guns and mortars and everything else. So he went. And
do you think he was blamed for somebody else's
mistake? Well, I think this is very difficult to know where the blame lay. Whether, as I say, he went off without the tanks. He was certainly to blame the fact that we didn't have our own anti-tank guns up there. Because as a CO,
they were under his hand, weren't they?
Well, they were under his command.
Yes.
And he was a commanding officer. Mm. He should have got some commendation, I think, for the spirit and the way in which the battalion behaved in very difficult circumstances. But nevertheless, he had to go. He was a very courageous officer. I'm not sure that he had the breadth of experience as a CO. He hadn't commanded anything, a battalion, before. He had a lot of battle experience in the desert. He commanded companies, and I think he'd been second in command of the 1st Battalion. But he was not a very outgoing sort of person. He was a delightful character, if you got to know him. Very kind, very polite, and obviously got a band of steel in him because he was a very courageous man. But he wasn't outgoing, he hadn't got charisma, to say. Whether he didn't have the opportunity of developing it in the time he had, I don't know. Perhaps he would have done, but he didn't have a chance to get himself across. I think he was probably limited a bit in his thinking. I think he may have just been a little bit limited there. But Geoffrey Edit was then the second in command from the Royal West Kents, was then given command. And I don't want in any way to compare the two, because there were different characters doing. Probably Higson may have been more courageous than Geoffrey, but Geoffrey showed much courage when he was with us. So swings and roundabouts. But he turned out to be a first-class CO. He'd been to the staff college as a young 25, I suppose. He'd been to the staff college. He got everything buttoned up. He never let anything go loose. He wasn't loose in his thinking. And he considered everything. He was very, very approachable. He was very great sense of humour. You could talk to him, but at the end of the day, he asked you what you wanted, this, that and the other. But at the end of the day, he made up his mind. He gave the orders. He was the boss. We obeyed him. But he was a brilliant CEO. And we took to him at once.
What you're saying, it sounds like he had a tighter grip.
Yes.
Than his predecessor.
Yes, yes, he did. Mm-hmm. And a better knowledge. He got amongst people. I think John Higson was a little shy. He didn't get amongst people. He didn't seem to communicate with the soldiers and the troops and, you know, on a sort of one-to-one basis.
Yes.
Whereas Geoffrey could get around and talk to people and joke and talk and everybody knew at the end of the day he was the boss. So it was strange having a Royal West Kent now, because we had a lot of front runners in the regiment, who had been adjutants and so forth, who could have come in. I can remember some of their names. One of them was James, Colonel James, who in fact was not very far from us, commanding an East Surrey regiment, I think, battalion, highly decorated, DSOs and bars. But he was Essex, he was down the road, in charge of an East Surrey. He got killed, unfortunately, very shortly after D-Day. And I saw his grave. I remember seeing his grave in near Jerry Peters' grave in Bayeux. Anyway, we had Geoffrey now as our CO.
You're saying that, you know, when the tanks and the anti-tank guns from the 22nd Armored Brigade turned up, you've got a very good consolidated position.
Mm.
How was that actually laid out?
I wish I could remember now. I can't. I really can't. We've been on the go now for 3 or 4 days. We haven't had much sleep.
Mm.
We certainly didn't get any sleep the night before. And we certainly didn't get any sleep the night before that in the wet orchard. So perhaps I wasn't beginning to take in everything that went on. I was just doing my job.
Yes.
I find, looking back, that I remember much more about the early days in detail like this than I do later on. Perhaps it's because one begins not to... It's not no longer something new. It's the same old things, you know. And also you're getting a bit tireder, you're not taking it in so much, you're not so observant about what's going on around you.
Were you aware of that at the time? Do you remember thinking to yourself, well, I'm doing things in a slower way, or I'm...
No, not really, no.
...pick up the thread because I'm tired?
No, I don't think so. We were doing things all right. It was merely that your mind wasn't sort of travelling around so much, so to speak.
Yes, focusing probably more on the immediate.
Yes, on the immediate things. But, of course, there were things which you could pick up your ears if there was something extra going on somewhere, like, as we shall see, a bomber command raid which came right over us.
Yes.
soon watched that, and I can remember that right from the start to finish.
How long did you stay in that position in Verrier, the orchards around
Verrier? We were taken out that same later that day.
What? So that the armour turned up in the morning.
Yes.
Or did they turn up before or after daylight?
Move during the dark.
Yeah, so
it was tank, what they call tank first light,
yes,
which is different from ours.
Yes,
they came up. Obviously, they weren't there at first light. Our anti-tank guns were there at first light because they could come up during the dark, and they were probably
was
in position.
Was this your own battalion?
Our own six pounders.
Yes.
But anything on tracks,
yes,
was obviously not there till an hour after first light, at least. I wouldn't think.
So tank first light is an hour after infantry first light?
Yes, it very much depends on the conditions. Sometimes it's brighter and darker. They decide themselves what tank first light is, I think, on the conditions. But it's usually about an hour, I think, as far as I can remember. So they wouldn't have come up immediately on first light, but they would have come up soon after. They may have... Well, they couldn't move them because it was dark when they got the order to come anyway, so they couldn't have done any preliminary moves in daylight the day before.
So they came up, and then they were with you for the day, and during the evening you...
And later that day we were told to withdraw.
Was this in daylight, the withdrawal?
It was still daylight, yes, because you remember we're in June, as we are now.
Indeed, the nights are short.
And the nights are short, and the days are long. And we did a withdrawal, as opposed to just turning around and walking away, because we didn't know whether the enemy was still there.
You were in contact, didn't
you? Yeah, so we had to do leapfrogging back with companies so that until we were right back, and then we went. Mm. We heard the enemy take... We took the place later.
They moved back in as you...
I believe
out.
They did, yes. Mm. I don't know who... Somebody... I don't know who took our place. We weren't relieved, I don't believe, at that time.
You weren't relieved in position?
No, I don't think we were.
Where did you just withdraw to? What was the...
Well, we came out to a place called Elon, I think it was, just behind.
Yes.
Where we stayed to lick our wounds for a couple of days. We had quite a lot to make up after that.
What was the condition and the strength then when you moved back?
We lost about a third, I suppose.
You lost a third of in that attack.
Yeah, of the front of the infantry companies.
Yes.
Yes, I think it was about a third that we'd lost.
Would that be Elon there, near just north of Monday?
Elon?
There.
Ellon, it was, yes. I think. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So that's a hamlet about 4 or 5 kilometres.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we stayed there for a couple of days, I think, whilst we sort of licked our wounds and had a bit of a rest. And it wasn't long after that that we found ourselves at the gates of Tilly.
When did you get replacements coming up to reconstitute?
Not at that stage, I don't think. No.
So you were very much under strength then.
Yes.
So you would be what, 400 men, perhaps a bit.
Oh no, the war establishment was very big actually. It was 800 or 900 at that stage. So we'd have been down to about 600. Yeah, but don't forget, that's the infantry companies. I mean, there's the S Company and Headquarter Company are still intact.
Yeah.
So I remember we went back, we were sent back in parties to Belyar to have baths in the public baths there. And I went back with my company and we went into the baths. And I went out because we were fairly sort of free at that time. You know, we were told to sort of get together again at a certain time. I went off to wander around the city and found the shops absolutely stacked full of cheese because they couldn't get it out of the bridgehead. The Lavashkiri.
The laughing cow.
That's right. Well, that was there in big numbers.
Yeah.
And camembert. And apparently whilst I was away, Monty came on the scene in the bars and handed out cigarettes and complimented them on what the Essex had done. So word had got back to him that we'd stayed where we were despite his conditions. But I missed him, so I never said hello. So he asked for the company commander, one of the chaps, but he said, no, he's not here. So that was my only chance of meeting the great man. Ask him for his autograph. And the other thing I noticed is that Bayeux was going on quite normally. People walking about the place, there were packets, crowds of press, media there, all staying in the best hotels.
As they do.
And large crowds of people just walking around in the streets as if nothing was happening anywhere else. Strange. I think you could hear the distant guns from our own gun lines, but otherwise it was peace. Anyway, we stayed there long. I can't remember how many days it was, or whether it was one or two. But by this time, of course, the attacks on Tilly... I hope I'm not offending your French accent when I say Tilly. That's what we called it. Tilly have been attacked several times, and the Gloucesters have been in and out. I know. We were given the job of taking it. And I can't remember how long it was after we had the place. But we'd obviously got ourselves together, had a couple of nights' sleep, and were ready again. And we found ourselves at the gates of Tilly. We did some patrolling there.
Which direction did you approach from, do you know? Were you coming down the road from Bayer?
Yes.
Down the D6?
Yes. Yes, it was that road.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
It's a long, straight road.
Yes.
Almost like a Roman road.
That's right. Yes. Boussiel, that's the name I remember.
Boussiel.
Yeah, Boussiel. We must have been there sort of on a transitory basis, I think.
Well, that's on the route to Tilly, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Yes.
Well, we got pretty near to it, but we were still not in touch with the enemy. And when we launched an attack, which I didn't take part in, with two companies, which got so far and then got bogged down and stopped because the enemy fire was so fierce.
Was this small arms fire, or was it?
Well, it was everything. It was everything.
Combination of
fire. Yes, yes. I think they were still several hundred yards short of the objective. That night, I was asked to provide some patrols, which I had been before. And with our reduced numbers and the same people going out on patrols and so forth, I hadn't the face to ask them to go out again, so I took a patrol out myself into Tilly.
Yes.
It was strange because I took a couple of blokes with me. We got pretty well almost into the centre. It was built up. I could just hear Germans shouting at one another. I heard one distinctly say, and you won't believe this, "Bus is los, Hans." But there didn't seem to be the opposition there that we were expecting. And it seemed that they had been pulling out. And the next day we almost walked in.
Do you remember what day that was?
I don't know whether I've made a note, whether I was able to. We did have, actually, the blokes in my patrol managed to get back without any trouble. One patrol which I sent out earlier under Murphy, who was one of my second lieutenants, known as Spud, of course. He was Irish, of course. And when he wasn't calling me sir, he was calling me skipper, which I didn't worry about too much. He was a great guy, actually. He kept us all amused. He took a patrol out, and he got badly shot up. He got back wounded. So he was evacuated, so I lost a platoon commander there. There was then a private he was with took cover underneath a small hut which Germans were in. He stayed there for a night at least, the whole rest of that night and the next night, and managed to get back. And he was able, because he'd seen, had a look around and seen where the enemy positions, what the enemy positions were. So he was able to tell us quite a bit. Or not me, but the intelligence officer, battalion intelligence officer. But they were the only casualties we had at that time in my company. The other two companies which attacked obviously had casualties as well during the attack. And then the next day, as far as I can remember, we went in, and the place was absolute shambles. There were knocked out German tanks, British tanks, burnt up cars, buildings. The whole place had been almost demolished, really. I can see it to this day.
What sort of positions had the Germans had then that the Murphy's private had noticed?
Well, he noticed some thick trenches around on either side of this hut, which must have been probably used as a platoon headquarters or something.
Yes.
But obviously it was useful to know where these were.
Yeah.
Even although they were only sort of local. But that's the first platoon commander I lost. The other one, Whitley, I think I lost here. I did make a note of that. He was killed.
When you got into Tilly, what did you do? Did you consolidate in the village or around the village?
We consolidated there, yes. I got a note here to say that we did it in cooperation with the DLI, who were also, a battalion of the DLI were also there.
The 151 Brigade, presumably.
I suppose so, yes.
So was this a two-battalion advance into Tilly?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it must have been.
But they were a different brigade, weren't they? They weren't in...
No, they weren't in our brigade at all. It was done in cooperation. I have no idea. I don't know. I was up the sharp end. I didn't know what they thought, what the people behind were saying to one another. But that's how it was. I can't remember which battalion it was, but I know there was a DLI battalion there. Just looking to see if I got a note here to say where Whitley was killed. It was either there or Essex Wood. Anyway, I lost the platoon commander. I lost two platoon commanders. By this time, I lost two platoon commanders.
What happened in those cases? Did the sergeants take over?
Yes, for the time being. Yeah. We had a brilliant sergeant. I remember his name now, Sergeant Copley. He's one of the old soldiers from the 1st Battalion and been in the desert and been with the battalion before the war. Nothing absolutely fazes chap. I mean, you know, there were shells and bombs and things going off all over the place. He could have been on Balham High Street. And he took over one of the two. And he got wounded not long afterwards, and I think it was at Tilly he got wounded. And I didn't see him again. Of course he was wounded. Funny thing is that when those guys got wounded, I usually got letters from them. Very often they would write. And they would all ask to come back because they had tremendous sort of affinity with their regiments in those days. Well, I suppose they still have. But these old soldiers who had served 7 years with the colours and five on the reserve, and some of them had come back from the reserves, some had served 12 years, and those who come back off the reserve were around their 30s, late 20s, early 30s. And they're all mature men, experienced. You can almost call them veterans, or I hate that word, because I think I mentioned before my idea of a veteran is somebody who fought in the Iberian Wars or went to Blenheim with Marlborough. But they always wanted to come back to their regiment. They didn't want to go off anywhere else.
Were you able to get your wounded back once they'd recovered? Did they come back to the...
No, they never came back to us. I don't remember any coming back to us. Towards the end, as you will see, when we're up in... Well, not towards the end. Towards the end of the time I was with the battalion, we were getting retread light ACAC gunners and jocks. Anybody could be rounded up to the press gang and sent off.
They could walk and carry a rifle.
They could walk and carry a rifle, yeah, and they did their best. But of course, by that time, it wasn't. These chaps, I used to call them. I recently called them the last of Kipling's soldiers, because they were something else. These guys. I know we get very good soldiers. We've always been lucky in the British Army and had good soldiers. But you don't get a whole crowd of blokes who've served for 7 and 12 years anymore and have seen the northwest frontier in India and served that sort of thing. You don't get that sort of thing now.
No, not nowadays.
But, of course, all the WOs, all the warrant officers, all the NCOs were still of that crowd, and many of the privates too. So we had a good stiffening of these chaps, hardcore. More than a hardcore, they were probably made up about
your old soldiers.
60% of the old soldiers, yeah. And they were steady as a rock, they were steady. They really were. I don't know whether Essex, Geoffrey had it called that, the wood in which we fought, he renamed it Essex Wood. And we always refer to it now as Essex Wood.
Do you know where that was? Was that, was that their next action after Tilly? Was
no, no, this was Verrier.
Verrier. That they was called Essex Wood.
Yes, yeah, but there was the wood where we yes. stayed that night with no tanks and anything. Mm. Well, we nicknamed it Essex Wood. I don't think anybody else does. But in fact, I don't know. Did you go to the Imperial War Museum to see their exhibition there called D-Day to Victory or something? Mm-hmm. There was a bit about our little battle there. It said that we'd had a particularly bloody battle. Second Essex had been involved in a bloody battle. On the written up on the side on the wall somewhere. Anyway, a lot of other people had bloody battles, and as well as us, and had more casualties, I think. However, we walked into Tilly, and as I say, it was a shambles.
Was it clear? I mean, Germans had a habit in some theatres of leaving mines and booby traps.
There were booby traps around, I remember, yes. Mm. I didn't actually activate any myself, but I think it was either the sappers came in and dealt with them. And there was always a fear of mines, especially on the verges of roads. You never knew when you were going to find mines, because they just put them anywhere. But usually after a big battle like this, you wouldn't find mines because they'd been there themselves.
Yes.
But they put them on the verges of the roads. If you drove off and drove a vehicle and drove it off onto the verge, you might get blown up with a telemine. Mm-hmm. In fact, my carrier went up on one, not at this stage, later on. The driver killed. He was the youngest of the whole lot. Private Jin, I remember, G-I-N-N. He was 19, and he was my carrier driver, and he got blown up and killed. And during war, during action like this, there was very seldom talk about the dead or the wounded, except to sort of say, well, I hope old Sensei got off all right, and that kind of thing. They're forgotten. It was bad for morale to start talking about the dead ones and so forth. You just put them out of your mind. It wasn't callous at all. It was just self-preservation for the whole lot. But on one occasion, I remember when Jin got killed, because he was so young compared with everybody else at 19. My old CQMS, Buller Parker, CQMS Parker, Suffolk Swede he was, we were walking along, and it just recently happened, and he came up beside me and said, it shouldn't happen to a young lad like that, should it, sir? And that was it. That's all he said. And the only way that you got involved with people who had been killed was from the letters from their next of kin, which we had to deal with.
Did you have to write to them as company commander?
Well, you didn't write off the top of your head straight away.
Yes.
What happened was their next of kin were advised in the UK that their husband or sons had been killed officially. They would then write to the CO and said, can you give me some more details about it? The CO would then farm out the letters to the company commanders. Then we wrote back.
Yes.
And on one occasion, the Corporal Bucknell, I remember, who got killed at an action after this, his wife Edna, we carried on a correspondence for the rest of the time I was there almost. She was so anxious to know where his belongings were, how he died. They all wanted to know how they died and so forth. What was so remarkable about these letters? There was no bitterness. There was no self-pity. Some of them said that they were proud that their son had done what he'd done, and of course he'd be greatly missed. Some of them had been bombed out of their houses altogether. And then they'd had other sons killed in North Africa, say. And yet their letters were so good and so matter of fact.
Sounds like a very Spartan.
Very, very Spartan. I've never said anybody who whined or bitched or in their letters. There was one guy called Corporal Haynes who was in the quartermaster's stores. Now, he was an old soldier. And he volunteered, he said, to come up in the front. And he came to my company, and poor chap